Sip on the go with a Starbucks Iced Shaken Espresso. Our signature roast, shaken with ice, then finished with a splash of milk. Customize it to match your style on the Starbucks app. Make today a good day.
DIY and Howl Studios presents
You Must Take the A-Train
Vinyl Snob with Dave Whitaker. Part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Network of Podcasts.
Imagine me and you, I do.
Music, culture, technology.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet.
And rock and roll. Now, let's drop the needle and start the show.
I'm Dave Whitaker, and this is Vinyl Snob.
And once I got a look at it out here, I just decided to move here. So in 1988, I got a U-Haul for my records. Because I actually needed a U-Haul for the records by that point.
That's Mike Lavella, writer, publisher, and avid record collector.
I noticed there was a rock and roll car crossover happening, but it wasn't being documented, so I got the idea to do Gearhead Magazine.
On this episode, we have the second installment of our series, Confessions of a Vinyl Addict. Plus, we take a field trip to Delta Breeze Records. So, when does collecting records go from a casual hobby to an obsession? And how does one start on and make that journey? Producer Dana Barry has part two of his series, Confessions of a Vinyl Addict.
Welcome back to Confessions of a Vinyl Addict. I got a tip from a friend of mine about someone I should interview. Someone whose reputation in the Bay Area vinyl community is as respected as a sealed first pressing. Mike Lavella was a writer for Maximum Rock and Roll and Thrasher, started the punk rock hot rod magazine Gearhead and the subsequent garage punk record label, and is now the organizer of a monthly Now Playing Night. He's also a lifelong record nut whose collection could crush a car. I visited Mike in his retro mod apartment in a 150-year-old former plating and stamping factory. He took me through the former stock room of his record label, up a staircase, and into a large living room where one long wall was supported by his record collection. Amongst his collection of novelty kitsch eye candy, I let the tape roll and listened to Mike recount the past and the path that led him down that slippery slope to vinyl addiction.
Mike Lavella, Oakland, California. I'm 53. I started collecting records when I was 8, seriously. I'd been given records by my family, but when I was 8, I became aware of, like, if I save up my money, I can buy them. And that's when it started. I'm from Hermony, Pennsylvania. I lived there for the first 18 years of my life. It's a small coal mining town in western PA. It's about 30 miles outside of Pittsburgh. Famous only for the fact that jazz great Sonny Clark was born there. And when I was 18, I moved to Pittsburgh, PA, and I was in punk bands. I was very, very involved in the punk scene. And then I was in a band called Half-Life for 5 years, and I played bass. And we made quite a few records and stuff over the years and toured. And actually, it was on the 1987 tour. We came out here and played at Gilman, like the first year it was open. And once I got a look at it out here, I just decided to move here. So in 1988, I got a U-Haul for my records, because I actually needed a U-Haul for the records by that point. But I got my first job at Bay Area Records and Tapes. The big job you had there when you worked at Bay Area Records and Tapes was you wiped records down. He had these bottles with whatever that formula is of, you know, ammonia versus water, you know, to like clean records. And we would spray them and wipe them. And I was so ambitious to get through them to find. And of course, I was finding like stuff for me the whole time. I was finding like the wipers, like all my wipers LPs came from that era, and like Funkadelic records I needed. And that was good for records. I mean, but it was terrible for money, you know, and I was spending probably a lot of what I made on records. And then shortly after that, I I got a job in record distribution, and I started doing that for a while, and that was better paid. But, and then simultaneously, I started writing for Maximum Rock and Roll. It was Tim Yohannan who invited me. In 1987, when Half-Life was playing at Gilman, Tim Yohannan said, you know, he was smoking, you know, he was like, yeah, if you could, he said, if you can write as good as you could talk, you know, I can give you a job, you know, to, like sucking on a Pall Mall, you know.
So out of that, Mike started writing for Maximum Rock and Roll and Thrasher. But how and why did he start his own magazine?
I noticed there was a rock and roll car crossover happening. I mean, you had Gas Huffer and the Super Suckers had Hot Rod Rally and all these, you know, people were starting to, the New Bomb Turks had a song called Dragstrip Riot. There was, it was happening, you know, but it wasn't being documented. So I got the idea to do Gearhead Magazine. And then the reason it came with the record, so the first 10 issues of Gearhead had a 45 in it. And the reason that, I did that was because I was working in record distribution. And I thought, well, I don't really know how to sell a magazine, but I know how to sell a record. So if I put a record in here, I can go through all the normal channels of record distribution.
Cool. Flexi discs.
No, they're hard vinyl singles that have a picture sleeve that's inside the magazine, which came in a bag. So I had to spend all this extra money to preserve the integrity of the record. But because there were some magazines at the time where somebody would do like a hard vinyl 7-inch, you know, and then they come in that generic white sleeve and they would like staple it into the magazine. Well, it's inevitably going to get mauled. I mean, like, not only the record, but the magazine. It's going to bend the hell. So I thought, how can I do this? So I made the magazine with a 100-pound cardstock cover so it would have some firmness. Then there was the record, you know, with like a, you know, label, you know, like, you know, legitimate 45 big hole in case people had a jukebox. I was very wary of that, you know, and then a picture sleeve and then a bag, and then that's inside. It was like free floating inside the magazine, which also came in a bag. I can't, whatever profit I ever would have made was certainly eaten up on bags. So then in 2000, I decided that pressing like 13,000 singles was crazy because who knew even how many people had turntables at that point that were buying the magazine. So I decided to split it. Then I did 8 more issues of the magazine without records and then started a record label. And I did that from 2000 to 2006. I put out 55 records. Between that time, I had the Hives on my label. I put out the first 4 Hives records in America, which is probably the thing it's most noted for.
So now we turn the discussion more towards collecting records.
With my collection, like for years, like you struggle with the term like record collector. Like, am I that or am I just a lover of music? I realized I was a record collector when Discogs came out, when the website came out, because I went through my whole collection and I kind of put it up there. Largely, originally, it was 2 things. Like, A, just to really figure out what do I actually have here? There's so many records, and it ended up being, I have like, I don't know, 13,000 records I put up initially or something, like thousands and thousands. And it took years to really, you know, grade them and put them up, but you can use that for insurance coverage. Like if some, you know, so actually I have renter's insurance. I have my records insured. Like I really do. I couldn't sleep if I didn't. They're worth, I mean, nobody was more shocked than me. It's coming right. It's about $250,000, you know, and what I paid for them is, I don't know, $200 or something, you know, because they were mostly given to me or promoed, or certainly when I published the magazine, you got promos, and then friends have labels and they give you that, or you trade, or you know. And then with Discogs, I went through everything. The things I didn't want, I sold. 100% of the money from selling records went to buy records I did want. So I never have to tap into like my paycheck to buy. I mean, I have never like, you know, went to work, made money, and used any of that money to buy a record, ever.
All right, this is starting to piss me off because I have spent so much money on records. But Mike, well, he's a professional collector.
You know, when you sell stuff on eBay or Discogs, it goes to PayPal, and they have a credit card you can get, PayPal card, and that's what I use when I buy records. So, again, if I'm in a store, I'm using money 100% that generated from the selling of other records, you know. And then I go through the collection all the time. And like, you know, if it's a situation of, well, I haven't heard this for 30 years. Oh, then you look it up. Oh my God, it's $200. Of course I sell it. Like if I don't, you know, I don't even remember what it sounds like. I probably don't love it that much. Unfortunately, over the years, I've had to sell a lot of the, especially like the hardcore punk stuff, just to pay rent and stuff. A few times I've played it and like, oh my God, this is great. And kept it. But generally speaking, once I decide to let something go, I just let it go.
Mike's part of a great group called Now Playing. If you haven't checked him out, check him out.
We have our group, you know, we have our Facebook group called Now Playing, and people, there's 30,000 people in it now, I think. You know, when you're playing a record, you take a picture of it and then you post it and then people talk about the record, which is really useful because there's like a hive mind thing going on there too, where if you don't know what pressing it is, or and then people can tell you so much about the band, the person, and then even to the point where it's even like that my uncle was in that band, or crazy things like that have come up. And then so we have now playing night, and it's the second Wednesday of every month, and we just had our 20th one, and I'm the only person, of course, that's done every one. I mean, I've done it with bronchitis. I moved the date of moving my mom into an old folks home so I could do it. You know, I'm nuts. Like, when I commit to something, that's it. But all these people come out and they have these amazing record collections, and then they'll do themes. They'll have like, you know, glam, all glam tonight, all pub rock tonight, all new wave of British heavy metal, all country, all soundtrack. And you want to talk about geeking out, like someone will play a record and people will like run up with their phones and take pictures of the record while it's playing, because they're just like, oh my God, you have that on vinyl, you know. And but it's not competitive at all. It's really like a geek out, you know, like it's just people are getting together to play their records, and it's records. Like you know, you would die before you would show up with a CD or something, you know, or an iPod. I mean, it's so vinyl centric, you know. And then people get into wood press. And then like sometimes like someone will play a record. This has happened more than once. Someone will put on a record and people will jump up like, oh my God. And then like halfway to going to look, they'll go, it's a repress. Then everyone will go sit down. like it's like they have the chance to see a real one. You know, in the end, it's just wanting to play our records for people in public that brought everybody together. You know, so that's been great.
So I had to ask the obligatory Holy Grail question. And of course he had one. But it was not what I was expecting.
The record I want more than any other record in the world, Alan Sherman, the Jewish comedian of Hello Mudda, Hello Fada fame. I have Everything He Ever Did. I have all his albums. But he made a record for the Scott Paper Company called Music to Dispense With that was given out only to employees of Scott Paper Company. And it's so rare. And I have it. They included it on the box set. And it's hilarious. It's like, you want to talk about a challenge. Like, the corporation hired him to write songs about paper cups and stuff. And he did. And it's just like, I've never seen it. There are record stores from here to certainly Pittsburgh to in Florida to... last year, I just got my Mustang and I drove up to Red Deer, Manitoba, which is north of Calgary, and I hit record stores the whole way. And I spent, you know, everything, you know, Portland, Tacoma, everywhere I went, Spokane, just hit, and I timed it so that I would be in town, you know, at 11 a.m. when record stores open, and I could shop it, then I'd drive in between to the next major city. Like, my whole trip was record store based, and everywhere I went, I wrote that down, like, Alan Sherman, Music to Dispense With, my name, my email address, I'm like, if you ever see this record, I'm like, this is your one chance to ream somebody. Like, if you call me up and you'd be like, you know what, gotta charge you $500, man, you know, I will come up, you know, I mean, I'm that, I want it so bad. I don't know why, really.
Okay, so is finding a record through Discogs anywhere near as satisfying as finding it while flipping through stacks?
If it had been on my want list for a long time, and it's some record that says, it shows you how many people want it and how many people have it. And if it's some record where it's like, you know, three people have it, one person, you know, and I'm the only one, you know, and it's never for sale, never for sale. And then finally someone has one. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, like, yeah, I do. Like, it's not, of course, nothing is as great as flipping through a crate and you're like, oh my God, is that, you know, one time at the flea market in Berkeley, you know, at the Ashby BART station, one time I was there with Tim Kerr from, you know, the Big Boys and et cetera, et cetera. And he was in town and we were over there and I was just going through records and I was trying to get every Funkadelic record and I had almost every one, but misfiled under the band America was a copy of America Eats Its Young. And then this guy had Funkadelic records. They were all like, $20 or $30. But then America Eats Its Young was $1 because he thought it was an America, the band America record. And I was just like, what? You know, you're flipping, you're seeing, like, you know, like, then you're sweating as you're handing the guy the dollar, you know, because you're like, oh, he's going to figure this out. He's going to see Funkadelic. You know, you kind of have your hand over the word Funkadelic, you know, or whatever, you know. So there's been things like that. And then you're just like, oh my God, you know, like, and then like, do I feel bad about that? No, because I treasure that damn record. Like, it's never leaving the collection. I played it 100 times, you know, Funky Dollar Bill. I spent a Funky Dollar Bill on that record.
Thanks to Mike LaVella for a great afternoon hanging out in his pad, listening to music and talking vinyl. Let's hear a few final thoughts on what it's all about.
My friend Spar recently said, what's the end game? He's like, where are you going with this? You don't have kids. You don't have, I'm like, I don't know. You know, so I recently actually started saying, like, I'll leave you this. Like, my cousin Bobby, his daughter Marissa, likes the Beatles. And I said, well, I will leave you my Beatles records. And, you know, like, my cousin Jamin loves Nick Cave. And I'm like, I will leave you my Birthday Party record. You know, I'm actually making a list of who gets what now, you know, and they're going to end up with stuff, you know. I doubt there will be a museum. It'll probably be, the collection will probably get broken up, but hopefully it'll go to the people that appreciate that artist the most. I don't, what else can I do? I'll be dead, you know. I don't want to be buried with any of them or anything crazy like that. Maybe throw an 8-track tape in there or something, you know, for the comedy appeal. If I have an open casket, you know, throw like a, you know, some truck stop 8-track in there. So that would keep me happy for eternity, you know.
For Vinyl Snob, this is Dana Barry.
Dana Barry is a writer and musician who filed his story from his studio in Oakland, California. If you'd like to see pictures of Mike's record collection, check out the Episode 9 page at vinylsnob.com. On this episode, we have a new twist to our used bin segment as we take you on a tour of our favorite used record stores. Starting out in my own backyard with Delta Breeze Records on 10th between Q and R in downtown Sacramento. Co-owner, Rick DiPrato.
The store's been here about a year and a half. We started out in West Sacramento on Jefferson, and we were there about 3 years, and we moved here about a year and a half ago. We sell all types of records, vinyl records. We sell cassette tapes. We have a few CDs. They're all a dollar a piece. We sell about one a month. Nobody wants CDs now. And we sell equipment, a lot of vintage equipment, and my partner works on the equipment, so we also repair the equipment. But we sell speakers, turntables, receivers, amplifiers, preamps, but mostly the vintage equipment. A lot of our records come through the door here, but, you know, I have always enjoyed finding records. I go everywhere, you know. I go to the Bay Area, I go to estate sales and every thrift shop and even other record stores. You know, I search them out. But a lot, it's kind of amazing how many records come through the door since we moved. I think it's a kind of a thriving area. We're just a half a block off the gentrified high rent district here. This is a low rent building, but it's surprising how many come through the door still. You would think records are kind of hot again, so you would think, you know, people would mostly sell them, you know, good records on eBay or Discogs or, you know, through the internet. But a lot of people, I guess, are, you know, maybe they're in a hurry for the money, or they're too lazy to sell them, because they do command pretty high prices on the internet now. You're appealing to people all over, you know, all over the world, so you can get a higher price. But a lot of them, yeah, they come through the door. It's funny, I, you know, having owned stores in the 70s and 80s, I saw the demise of, you know, the vinyl record. I thought, you know, in the 80s, everybody brought their collections to me and said, I'm going CD, you know, and I told them all, every one of them, you should probably, like, keep a lot of these. And a lot of them were my friends. They had become my friends over the years, customers. And now I have a lot of them coming back saying, I sold you all my records in the 80s, you know, and now they're collecting again. But it was interesting. I got really kind of disgusted, sad in the 80s. And so I went on a vacation to Western Europe, and I went to Spain, and I noticed that records were just amazingly hot in Spain. This was 1988. So I decided, I found what I thought was a perfect location in Valencia, Spain, came back and planned on selling my shop and wanted to move to Spain. In fact, I even took my ex-wife over there, and we had two boys, and, you know, tried to get her to move over there, but she said, You know, the boys don't want to move to Spain. Plus, I had to deposit $100,000 in a Spanish bank to do business there as an American. So I was about $90,000 short. So I kind of gave up on that idea. But then all of a sudden, it was like, it just dawned on people that they could get digital music, you know, MP3s downloading, but it was all digital. So then people kind of realized, gee, I kind of like the sound of my old records, you know. Plus, I think a lot of it's sort of a nostalgia thing. And it's the process of, you know, taking it out of the jacket, reading the jacket, looking at the artwork. I think people are comfortable, most comfortable with the technology that they grow up with. It's surprising how young people have really embraced the vinyl record, you know, that technology. Half my customers, or more than half, are young people. My son, I would always get into his car and he'd plug his phone in and put on some downloaded music from his iPhone or whatever. And I would always tell him, Dante, this sounds like crap. This sounds like absolute crap. No, no, Pop, it sounds good. Well, it doesn't sound good. I mean, you know, there is a difference. The sound of good speakers with a good amplifier or receiver with a decent cartridge on a turntable, there really is a difference. Yeah, it's kind of like rock and roll. You know, I remember when rock and roll came out, basically, and I remember my parents and grandparents hating it. And I remember the pundits or everybody saying, oh, yeah, rock and roll, that's going to be gone soon. You know, we'll have Mitch Miller back in no time, you know. But it never went away. It's, you know, it's as big today or bigger than, you know, than it ever was. Records came out. The vinyl records, they went from the shellac, you know, 78s to the vinyl records just about the time that rock and roll came into existence. Records kind of grew up with rock and roll. So I think it's kind of like rock and roll. It's just, yeah, I don't think they're going to go away. I'm sure, you know, hundreds of years, they'll probably be gone. But definitely through my lifetime, I think records are here to stay.
Many thanks to Rick DiPrato with Delta Breeze Records for taking the time to talk to me. And that's our program. To hear the extended music version of this show, go to the Episode 9 page at vinylsnob.com. And don't forget, we feature pictures of all our interview segments on those same episode pages, along with helpful links on the recommendations page, free domestic shipping on all Vinyl Snob gear at the store, and Vinyl Snob Radio, one-hour DJ shows featuring many of the artists interviewed here on the Pantheon Network. Curated and hosted by yours truly, and of course, all from vinyl. If you have any questions about vinyl records or stereo equipment, we'd be happy to look into it. Drop me an email, dave@vinylsnob.com. If we use it in the show, we'll send you a Vinyl Snob t-shirt and tote bag, and you can watch heads turn the next time you walk into the record store. Vinyl Snob is produced at the studios of Post Audio in Sacramento, California. Executive producers Dana Barry, and our theme music composed by Cameron Robbins. I'm Dave Whitaker. Thanks for listening.
Vinyl Snob is produced by DIY and Howe and is part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Vinyl Snob is written by Dave Whitaker. All commentary and opinions are that of the host. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. Playlists can be found at Spotify. Purchase these great and important tracks. All songs, clips, and references can be found on our show notes. Please visit rockandrollarchaeology.com for more information.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett. Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.